Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are strapping ourselves in, really getting into the engine room of the AWS cloud.
Yeah, absolutely.
Forget databases, storage, networking for a minute. We're focusing just on compute.
The core stuff.
Exactly. These services, they're the foundation, right? The virtual servers, containers, the places your code actually runs.
Mm-hmm. If compute's the engine, then, well, understanding it is like having the driver's manual for a cloud architecture. You just can't build anything scalable or resilient or, you know, cost effective without getting this layer right.
So our mission today is pretty specific.
Yeah, we want to give you that critical shortcut, sort of distill the must-know info about EC2, Lambda, ELB, auto-scaling.
And how they all work together.
Exactly. For scalability, elasticity, and crucially keeping costs down.
And for you listening, this is probably the area to focus on for quick expertise gains. It's not just knowing the names.
No, not at all.
It's about understanding the trade-offs, the why behind choosing one over another. If someone asks where we run this code, well, the answer is always complex.
Always.
But for traditional apps, the kind that are always on, the starting point is almost always the same thing, isn't it?
It is. Amazon EC2.
Elastic Compute Cloud.
Right. When you think virtual machine or server in the cloud, 9 times out of 10, you're thinking EC2.
Mm.
It's honestly, it's probably the single most important service to really get your head around first.
Because it's infrastructure as a service.
Exactly. It gives you that secure, resizable compute capacity. Those virtual servers are called instances. It's the closest thing you get to, like, bare metal in the cloud.
Okay, let's unpack that then. EC2, the virtual server. Launching one isn't just a button click, though. You have to define things. The recipe, the power, the access.
Right. You need to configure it. We could break it down into three core components you must define.
Okay.
First up, the Amazon Machine Image, or AMI.
AMI.
Think of the AMI as the template. It's the recipe for the server's brain, basically.
Okay.
It contains all the software config, the OS, maybe an application server like Apache, your applications. It defines what the server actually is.
So the AMI sets the software blueprint. Got it. But servers need hardware, too. How do we define the horsepower for this virtual machine?
That's the instance type. And this is where, frankly, architects spend a lot of time optimizing.
Makes sense.
The instance type determines the whole hardware profile of the computer it's running on. We're talking virtual CPUs, vCPUs, RAM, storage options, network performance. It's the whole package.
And it's not just one size fits all, right? AWS has loads of these different families.
Oh, absolutely. Tons. And knowing the families is key. It often gets glossed over. You really need to pick the right tool for the job.
So what are the main ones we should know?
Well, the most common you'll bump into are probably the M, C, and R families.
M, C, R, okay.
M family, think M for main, or maybe multipurpose. It's general purpose. Good balance of CPU, memory, network. Great starting point for web servers, small databases, that kind of thing.
Okay, general stuff.
Then the C family. C for compute optimized. These are CPU powerhouses. High performance computing, batch jobs, video encoding. Anything that really hammers the processor.
Got it. CPU heavy.
And conversely, the R family, R for RAM, memory optimized. These are for things that need loads of memory. Big databases, memory caches, data analytics that chew through RAM.
So M for balanced, C for CPU, R for RAM. That makes sense. So if I'm running just a standard website, probably start with an M. But if I'm doing heavy data crunching.
You'd look at an R, definitely. Or maybe a C if the crunching is CPU bound. Making that choice right saves money. You're not paying for RAM you don't need. Or CPU you're not using.
That makes a lot of sense. Are there other important types?
Yeah, a couple of others worth mentioning. The T family, like T2, T3, T4G. Those are the burst instances.
Burst.
Yeah, they have a baseline CPU level but can burst higher for short periods. Great for dev test environments, things that are mostly idle but need occasional power. Very cost effective for that.
Okay.
And then you get into the really specialized stuff. P and G families for machine learning with GPUs. X families for massive memory needs. But M, C, R, and T cover a huge range of use cases. Choosing the instance type is, like, fundamentally about performance versus cost.
Right. Okay, so we have the recipe, AMI, and the power instance type. We need a way in securely. That's the third piece.
That's the key pair. Absolutely essential for secure admin access, like SSHing into a Linux box or RDPing into Windows.
How does that work?
It's a pair of cryptographic keys. There's a public key, which AWS stores and puts on the instance when it launches. And then there's a private key.
And that's the one I keep.
That's the one you keep. And you guard it carefully on your own machine. AWS doesn't keep the private key. Lose it, and you can't log in.
Oh, okay.
And this is a perfect, really clear example of the shared responsibility model.
Right. AWS secures the cloud itself.
The hardware, the network, the facilities.
But I'm responsible for security in the cloud.
Exactly. Managing that private key, patching your OS, configuring firewalls. It's on you.
That distinction is so important. Okay, let's pivot now. We know what an EC2 instance is. How do we pay for it? Because this is where decisions have huge financial impact. Four pricing models.
Yep, four main ways. And getting this right is, like, foundational for cost optimization, which is a pillar of the well-architected framework.
Let's start with the default, the most flexible one, on-demand instances.
Simplest model. Pay by the hour, or even by the second now, for Linux instances. Zero upfront commitment. Need capacity, you get it immediately.
So when would I use that?
Perfect for short-term stuff. Irregular workloads, things you can't predict, development, testing. Anything where you need capacity now, you don't want it interrupted, but you don't know how long you'll need it for.
But you pay the highest price for that flexibility.
You do. It's the baseline rate.
Okay. So if on-demand is about flexibility, the next one is about commitment for savings, reserved instances, and the newer savings plans.
Exactly. This is the core strategy if you know you need servers running long-term. Think steady state, predictable workloads.
Like my main production web servers.
Precisely. If you commit to using compute for a one-year or three-year term, AWS gives you a significant discount, up to 72% off the on-demand price.
72%. That's massive.
It really is. And the newer savings plans are generally better, more flexible than the older IIs.
How so?
Well, traditional IIs locked you into a specific instance, family, size, region, OS, quite rigid. Savings plans are more flexible. You commit to a certain dollar amount of spend per hour, say $10 an hour, for 1 or 3 years.
Okay.
And that discount applies much more broadly. If you change instance families within that commitment, say from an M5 to an M6, or even move region sometimes, the savings plan discount often still applies. Much easier to manage.
So the bottom line, if it runs 247, commit to a savings plan.
Absolutely. That's a primary way to save big on predictable usage.
Okay, now the extreme end of savings, the one that sounds almost too good to be true, spot instances. Up to 90% off.
Yep, Spot can offer truly massive discounts. You're basically bidding on spare, unused EC2 capacity that AWS has lying around.
So what's the catch? There's always a catch with 90% off.
The catch is interruption. Because it's spare capacity, AWS can reclaim it whenever they need it back for on-demand or reserved customers.
Reclaim it, like just turn it off.
Pretty much. They give you a 2-minute warning and then boom, the instance is terminated.
2 minutes? That's not a lot of time.
It's not. Which means Spot is only suitable for certain types of workloads.
Like what? How do you use that warning?
Your application has to be genuinely fault tolerant and, ideally, stateless. It needs to be able to handle that interruption gracefully.
Yeah.
Meaning it shouldn't store critical data only on that instance. It needs to be able to, say, checkpoint its work, save its state somewhere durable, like S3 or a database, and shut down cleanly within those 2 minutes. That another instance, maybe the Spot instance, an on-demand one, can pick up where it left off.
Okay, so things like batch processing, big data jobs, rendering.
Exactly. Tasks that can be stopped and restarted without losing everything. Things that are maybe distributed across many instances anyway, if it's your main customer-facing database or a critical web server that absolutely cannot go down unexpectedly.
Don't use Spot.
Never use Spot for that.
Yeah.
It's a huge architectural trade-off. Stability versus massive cost savings.
Got it. Okay, one more pricing model. The niche one, dedicated hosts.
Right. A dedicated host is just what it sounds like, a physical server in an AWS data center that's entirely dedicated to your use. No other AWS customer shares that underlying hardware.
Why would someone need that? Isn't the whole point of cloud shared infrastructure?
Usually it's not about cost savings. It's almost always about compliance or licensing.
Ah, licensing, like software that's licensed per physical core?
Exactly. Some legacy software, maybe bring your own license, BYOL scenarios, have licensing terms tied to physical hardware sockets or cores. Dedicated hosts let you meet those terms. Or sometimes very strict regulatory requirements might mandate physical isolation.
So it's a compliance tool, not really a cost-saving tool.
Primarily, yes. It's more expensive than other options.
Okay, that covers the single server, EC2, really well. But like we said, one server isn't resilient. It can't handle big traffic swings. So we need to move up a level, domain 2, scaling and high availability.
Right. Moving beyond the single instance to the services that make your application resilient, available, and able to handle fluctuating demand. This naturally brings us to elastic load balancing, ELB.
The load balancer. So this sits in front of my EC2 instances.
Correct. It acts as the single front door, the single point of contact for all your users or clients. Its main job is to take that incoming traffic and distribute it intelligently across your fleet of EC2 instances running the application.
Distributing the load makes sense. But it does more than that, right, for availability?
Absolutely. Its second key function is ensuring high availability. The best practice is to run your EC2 instances across multiple availability zones, or AZs.
And AZs are separate data centers within a region.
Physically separate, yes. Independent power, cooling, networking. So the ELB spreads the traffic across instances in, say, AZ1 and AZ2. If something catastrophic happens and the entire AZ1 goes offline.
The load balancer just sends traffic to the instances still healthy in AZ2.
Precisely. Your application stays up. That's high availability in practice, enabled by the ELB.
You said it's a single point of contact, but there isn't just one type of load balancer anymore, is there? This trips people up.
That's a really important point. There are a few types, but the main two you need to understand are the application load balancer, ALB, and the network load balancer, NLB.
ALB and NLB. Difference?
They operate at different layers of the network stack. The ALB works at layer 7, the application layer.
Meaning it understands HTTP, HTTPS.
Exactly. It's smart. It can look inside the request at the URL path, the host name, HTTP headers, and make sophisticated routing decisions based on that content. Want to send images traffic to one set of servers and AP to another? ALB can do that. Perfect for modern microservices or complex web apps.
Okay, ALB is the smart one for web traffic. What about NLB?
NLB operates at layer 4, the transport layer, TCP, UDP.
So it doesn't look inside the application request?
Nope, it just looks at IP address and port information. It's incredibly fast and designed for ultra-high performance, millions of requests per second with very low latency. Because it's simpler, it's faster. Great for TCP traffic, UDP, or situations where you need extreme throughput or a static IP address for your load balancer endpoint.
So ALB for smart application routing, NLB for raw speed and throughput.
Got it. And the load balancer also checks if the instances behind it are actually working. Health checks.
Critically important, yes. The ELB constantly pings its registered targets, your EC2 instances, using configured health checks. Could be checking a specific web page, a port.
And if an instance fails that check, maybe the app crashed.
The ELB immediately marks it as unhealthy and stops sending any new traffic to it, automatically, instantly. It routes traffic only to the healthy instances. This is key for user experience. Nobody wants to hit a dead server. Okay, that covers spreading the load and staying highly available. But what about handling those traffic spikes? Scaling up for a sale, scaling down overnight. That elasticity part.
That's where the partner service comes in. Amazon EC2 auto-scaling. ASG.
Auto-scaling.
This is the magic behind true elasticity. And honestly, probably the single biggest cost optimization tool for workloads with variable traffic. ASG automatically adds more EC2 instances that scale out when demand goes up and removes instances scale in when demand drops.
So you're only paying for the capacity you actually need right now.
Exactly. No more over-provisioning massive fleets just to handle peak load, which was the old data center nightmare. ASG matches capacity to demand dynamically.
How do you set it up? You must tell it how to scale.
You do. You define an auto-scaling group, and there are three key capacity settings you configure. The minimum capacity. The absolute smallest number of instances you always want running, maybe for base availability.
Yeah.
The maximum capacity, the upper limit, your cost ceiling, stops it running away.
Right.
And the desired capacity, what the ASG should aim for under normal conditions or what it starts with.
Min, max, desired, the boundaries. And what actually triggers the scaling, adding or removing instances.
Those are the scaling policies. You define the conditions. It could be a simple policy like if average CPU across the fleet goes above 70% for 5 minutes, add 2 instances.
Okay.
But the more modern and usually recommended approach is target tracking scaling.
Target tracking.
Yeah, it's much simpler to manage. You just tell the ASG, I want to maintain an average CPU utilization of, say, 60% across all instances. And the ASG does the math automatically adding or removing instances as needed to keep that target metric stable. You can target CPU, network traffic, request count per instance from the ELB. It's quite powerful.
Oh, that sounds much easier to set the target.
It generally is.
So we see the synergy here. The ELB takes the incoming traffic, spreads it across AZs for availability. The ASG watches the instances behind the ELB and automatically adjusts the fleet size to match the demand the ELB is seeing based on metrics like CPU.
That's a classic bread and butter architecture for a scalable, resilient web application on AWS. EC2 instances, managed by an ASG, sitting behind an ELB, usually an ALB. You'll see that pattern everywhere.
Okay, but what if I don't want to manage any of that? No EC2 instances, no AMIs, no OS patching, no configuring ASGs.
Ah, now you're talking about a fundamental shift. That brings us neatly into domain 3. Serverless compute, and the poster child for that is AWS Lambda.
Serverless, which, as you always have to point out, doesn't mean no servers.
Right. It's a bit of a misnomer. The servers definitely exist. The crucial difference is you don't manage them. AWS handles all the underlying infrastructure.
And Lambda is the core service here. Function as a service or face.
Exactly. Lambda lets you run your code without thinking about provisioning or managing servers at all.
What's the key principle? What burden does it lift?
Basically, everything related to infrastructure management. AWS handles provisioning the compute capacity, the automatic scaling, patching the operating systems, all the underlying administration. You, the developer, just focus on writing the code for your function. That's it.
That sounds like a massive reduction in operational work.
It is. Huge.
And unlike an EC2 web server that's running 24/7 waiting for requests, Lambda works differently.
Fundamentally different. Lambda is event-driven.
Event-driven.
Meaning
your Lambda function sits there, dormant, until something triggers it. An event happens in your AWS environment, and that event invokes the function.
What kind of events?
All sorts. An image file gets uploaded to an S3 bucket, a message arrives on an SQS queue, a record gets updated in a DynamoDB table, a user logs in via Cognito, or very commonly an HTTP request comes in through API Gateway. The function only runs in response to these triggers.
That's reactive.
Totally reactive. It sleeps until woken up by an event.
And that has a huge impact on cost, right?
Yeah.
The pay-per-use billing. This is the killer feature for cost optimization on intermittent workloads. If your Lambda function isn't running, if it's idle, you pay absolutely nothing. Zero.
Wow.
You only get charged for two things. The number of times your function is invoked, the number of requests, and the total time your code spends executing, measured in milliseconds.
Milliseconds.
Down to the millisecond. If your function runs for, say, 500 milliseconds, you pay for exactly 500 milliseconds of compute time. Compare that to an EC2 instance that you pay for 247, even if it's idle 90% of the time. The efficiency is incredible for the right workload.
And scaling. If I suddenly get 1,000 S3 uploads at once.
The scaling is also totally different from EC2. It's automatic and near instantaneous. Lambda has massive built-in concurrency. If the 1,000 events hit simultaneously, Lambda will try to spin up 1,000 parallel execution environments to run your function concurrently to handle that burst. You don't configure min-max instances or scaling policies like with ASG.
It just happens.
It just handles it. Up to your account's concurrency limits, of course, but those are typically very high.
That seamless scaling sounds amazing, but there must be a trade-off. What about performance? Especially for that first request. I've heard about cold starts.
Ah, yes, the cold start.
Yeah.
That is the main operational trade-off you need to be aware of, especially for latency-sensitive applications.
What is it exactly?
Well, if your Lambda function hasn't been invoked for a while, AWS might tear down the underlying container or execution environment to save resources. When the next request comes in, Lambda has to do some setup work first, find capacity, provision the environment, download your code, initialize the runtime.
Before your code even starts running.
Exactly. That initialization phase is the cold start. It can add latency, sometimes just tens or hundreds of milliseconds, but sometimes for complex functions or certain runtimes, it could be a second or two.
And that extra latency happens only on the first request after a period of inactivity?
Generally, yes, or when scaling up rapidly requires new environments. Subsequent requests to a warm environment are usually much faster.
So that cold start latency could be unacceptable for, say, a real-time API endpoint where users expect an instant response.
It absolutely could. You're essentially trading potentially higher, unpredictable latency on some invocations for the benefit of lower cost and zero server management.
So it's a conscious choice based on the workload's priorities.
Always. Is consistent low latency paramount? Maybe EC2 is better. Is cost efficiency and minimal ops overhead the driver? Lambda looks very attractive.
This leads us right into the core comparison, EC2 versus Lambda. Let's really nail down the key differences because this comes up all the time.
Definitely. Let's break it down.
Okay, first, the basic model.
EC2 is infrastructure as a service, IaaS. You rent the virtual server hardware. Lambda is function as a service, AAS, or serverless. You rent code execution time.
Server management.
With EC2, it's all you. OS patching, installing software, managing scaling, security hardening, Lambda. AWS manages everything under the hood. You just manage your function code. EC2 needs you to configure auto-scaling groups, define policies, set min-max limits. Lambda scaling is built in, automatic, instantaneous.
Billing.
EC2. Pay while it's running, even if idle. You pay for that standby capacity. Lambda. Pay only for requests and execution time in milliseconds. Zero cost when idle.
And the big constraint, how long can they run?
EC2 instances can run indefinitely, 247 for years if you want. Lambda functions have a maximum execution timeout. Currently, it's 15 minutes.
900 seconds.
Only 15 minutes?
Yep. If your task takes 16 minutes to complete, Lambda is simply not an option. You'd need EC2 or maybe containers.
Okay, so that clearly defines the sweet spot for each. EC2-4.
Long-running applications, web servers, APIs needing consistent low-latency databases, anything that needs to run continuously or for longer than 15 minutes. Persistent services.
And Lambda 4. Intermittent, event-driven tasks, short-running jobs, back-end processing triggered by events, like that S3 upload example, APIs where a potential cold start is acceptable. Anything where cost efficiency for infrequent execution is key, and the 15-minute limit isn't an issue. Zero infrastructure management is the goal.
That distinction is critical. Get that wrong, and you're either overspending or using the wrong tool.
Absolutely fundamental.
Okay, moving on. We've done VMs, EC2, functions, Lambda. What about containers? Docker is huge now, packaging apps and dependencies together. That brings us to domain 4, container services.
Right, containers solve that classic, well, it works on my machine problem by packaging everything needed into a single unit.
Yeah.
Ensures consistency, but running containers at scale,
yeah,
that needs management. An orchestrator.
And AWS gives us choices for orchestration.
Two main ones. First, there's Amazon Elastic Container Service, ECS.
ECS, that's AWS's own one.
Yep, their native homegrown container orchestration service. It's highly scalable, fast, and designed for really tight integration with other AWS services like IAM, VPC, load balancers. Often preferred if you're already deep in the AWS ecosystem and want something simpler to manage than the alternative.
And the alternative is?
The industry standard.
Yeah.
Kubernetes. AWS offers Amazon Elastic Kubernetes Service, EKS.
EKS for Kubernetes.
Right. EKS is a managed service that lets you run standard open source Kubernetes on AWS without having to deal with the nightmare of installing and managing the Kubernetes control plane yourself, which is notoriously complex. Teams already using Kubernetes or wanting that open source portability often choose EKS.
So ECS is the AWS native way, EKS is the managed open source Kubernetes way. But with the, both of these, traditionally, you still had to run your containers on something, right? Like on EC2 instances?
Exactly. You'd set up ECS or EKS, but then you'd also need to provision and manage a cluster of EC2 instances to actually host your container tasks or pods. You still had to worry about patching those EC2 instances, scaling them with ASGs, optimizing the instance types.
Which sounds like we're back to managing servers again, even with containers.
It does, yeah. And that's where the real game changer comes in, combining containers with that serverless idea we talked about, AWS Fargate.
Fargate. Okay, what is Fargate? Is it another orchestrator?
No, that's the key thing. Fargate is not an orchestrator. It's a serverless compute engine that works with both ECS and EKS.
A serverless engine for containers.
Precisely. When you use Fargate, you completely eliminate the need to provision, manage, patch, or scale that underlying cluster of EC2 virtual machines.
How does that work?
You just define your container task for ECS or pod for EKS, as usual. You specify the CPU and memory resources your container needs. Then you tell ECS or EKS to launch it using the Fargate launch type.
And Fargate just runs it without me picking an EC2 instance.
Exactly. Fargate finds the capacity and runs your container on fully managed infrastructure. You don't see or manage any EC2 instances at all. It's like Lambda, but for containers.
Wow. So the takeaway is Fargate is the serverless way to run containers on AWS using either ECS or EKS as the orchestrator.
That's the perfect summary. You choose your orchestrator, ECS or EKS, and then you choose your launch type, either EC2 if you want control over the VMs, or Fargate if you want serverless.
That feels like a really powerful option for teams who love containers but hate managing VMs.
It really is. It simplifies operations massively. Focus on your containers, not the infrastructure they run on.
Okay, we've covered the big three execution models. IaaS with EC2, FaaS with Lambda, and serverless containers with Fargate. Let's quickly touch on domain 5, other key compute-related services. These seem like tools for specific situations.
Yeah, these are more specialized, often providing higher levels of abstraction or solving niche problems like location.
Let's start with AWS Elastic Beanstalk. I hear this described as PaaS platform as a service.
That's exactly what it is. Elastic Beanstalk sits between raw IS like EC2 and pure FADAs like Lambda.
What's its job?
Its core function is to make it super easy to deploy and scale standard web applications and services. Think apps written in Java, .NET, PHP, Node.js, Python, Ruby, Go, Docker.
Okay, so how does it make it easy?
The magic of Beanstalk is abstraction. You basically just upload your application code.
My WAR file or my Python code.
Yep. And Elastic Beanstalk automatically handles provisioning and managing the entire underlying environment stack needed to run it.
The whole stack. What does that include?
It provisions the EC2 instances, sets up the auto-scaling group, configures the Elastic Load Balancer, creates security groups, manages application versions, handles deployments like rolling updates or immutable deployments. Mm-hmm. All of that infrastructure complexity is managed for you based on your application type.
So it's using EC2, ASG, ELB under the covers, but hiding the configuration details.
Precisely. It abstracts away that lower-level infrastructure configuration, letting developers focus just on writing code, not on wiring together AWS services.
So, if you hear about a developer wanting to deploy a web app quickly, needing scaling and load balancing, but explicitly not wanting to manage the underlying AWS resources, Elastic Beanstalk sounds like the answer.
It's very often the answer in that scenario. The perfect BEIS is middle ground.
Okay, next up, something quite different. AWS Outposts. This sounds like bringing AWS home.
It kind of is. Outposts is a unique service that literally extends AWS infrastructure, the same hardware, services, APIs, and tools you use in an AWS region, directly into your own on-premises data center or colocation facility.
Why would you need to do that? Isn't the point of cloud not running stuff in your own data center?
Usually for two main reasons. Latency or data residency?
Latency.
Yeah. Imagine you have an application that requires extremely low latency, like single-digit millisecond response times, maybe for factory automation or real-time financial trading. The physical distance to the nearest AWS region might introduce too much network latency. Outposts lets you run those AWS services locally right next to your end users or equipment.
And data residency.
Some industries or countries have very strict regulations that require certain data to physically remain within a specific location, like the customer's own building or country. Outposts allows you to process that data using familiar AWS services while ensuring it never leaves your premises.
So Outposts is the answer when you need AWS compute locally.
Exactly. Cloud infrastructure on your turf.
Okay, one more in this category. Amazon LightSail. This sounds simpler.
Much simpler. LightSail is designed to be the absolute easiest way to get started with a virtual private server, VPS, on AWS.
Easier than EC2.
Way easier. Think of people coming from traditional VPS providers like DigitalOcean or Linode. EC2, with all its options, AMIs, instance types, security groups, EBS volumes, VPCs, can be overwhelming for beginners.
So how does LightSail simplify it?
It bundles everything you need into a single, simple package with a predictable, low monthly price. You choose a plan like $5 per month, and it includes a virtual machine with a set amount of CPU, RAM, SSD storage, and data transfer allowance, plus networking and a static IP address.
Ah, fixed monthly cost. Very predictable.
Very predictable. It's perfect for beginners, students, developers wanting to run a simple website, blog, dev environment, or small application without needing the granular control and potential cost variability of full EC2. Simple, fixed price VPS.
Got it. Easy mode VPS. Okay, that was a whirlwind tour of the compute landscape. Let's try to bring it all together in Domain 7, application and core cloud concept review. How do these services map back to those key cloud pillars we started with?
Right, this is where we connect the dots. The pillars guide our choices.
Let's start with elasticity, scaling up and down automatically.
The key service for EC2 is Amazon EC2 Auto Scaling, ASG. That's what provides the automatic adjustment. For serverless, like Lambda and Fargate, elasticity is just built in, handled by the platform.
Okay. What about scalability, handling growth over time?
For EC2-based applications, scalability is really achieved by the ELB and ASG working together. The ELB distributes increasing load, and the ASG adds instances to handle that load.
High availability, running across multiple AZs, surviving failures.
The linchpin there is the Elastic Load Balancer, ELB. It's what distributes traffic across those multiple AZs and routes around failures.
And the big one, cost optimization, getting the best bang for your buck.
Here, the choices are critical. Using spot instances for fault-tolerant work for massive savings. Committing via savings plans or IIs for predictable workloads. Or choosing Lambda for intermittent tasks to eliminate idle costs entirely. It's about matching the pricing model to the workload pattern.
And that final concept, serverless, where AWS manages the infrastructure.
That's embodied by AWS Lambda for functions and AWS Fargate for containers, shifting operational responsibility to AWS.
Okay, let's make this really concrete. Scenario time. Let's force ourselves to pick the right service. Ready?
Let's do it.
Scenario one, an e-commerce site. Global traffic, huge spikes during sales, needs to be always up, needs to scale automatically.
Okay, variable traffic, high availability needed, automatic scaling. That classic pattern, you need the trifecta. EC2 instances for the compute, managed by an auto-scaling group for the elasticity and cost savings, sitting behind an application load balancer, ALB, for the intelligent traffic distribution and HA across AZs.
Makes perfect sense. Scenario two, a simple script. Resizes images whenever they land in an S3 bucket. Runs for maybe 10 seconds, needs to be super cheap.
Keywords, event-driven S3 upload, short execution time, 10 secs, cost is paramount. That screams AWS Lambda. EC2 would be massive overkill and way more expensive because you'd pay for idle time. Lambda only charges for those 10 seconds.
Perfect. Scenario three, a big bank runs an analytics app using Docker containers. The ops team loves containers but hates managing VMs. They want the simplest possible way to run these containers.
Containers, yes. No VM management. That points directly to AWS Fargate. They'd use Fargate as a launch type with either ECS or EKS as their orchestrator. Serverless containers.
Got it. Takes the EC2 burden away. Scenario four. A developer has a new Ruby on Rails web app. Needs HA, load balancing, scaling, the works. But they don't want to mess with CloudFormation or manually configure ASGs and ELBs. They just want to deploy the code.
They're asking for that platform as a service abstraction. The answer is AWS Elastic Beanstalk. Upload the Ruby code. Mm-hmm. Beanstalk builds and manages the whole scalable load balanced environment automatically.
Excellent. Those scenarios really help crystallize the choices. Well, that brings us towards the end of this deep dive. We've really traced the evolution, haven't we? From managing the virtual machine completely yourself with EC2.
Right. Maximum control, maximum responsibility.
To outsourcing a lot of that configuration complexity with Elastic Beanstalk. Picking.
Giving up some control for operational ease.
All the way to letting AWS handle basically the entire operational environment for your code with Lambda, FaLS, or Fargate.
Minimum operational overhead, maximum focus on code, but with certain constraints like execution time or cold starts.
Understanding those three models, IS, PiS, FaCe, serverless, is really the core takeaway, isn't it?
It absolutely is, because your choice isn't just technical. It's a strategic decision about where your team invests its time and effort, managing infrastructure or building features.
And that really sets up our final provocative thought for you, the listener, to mull over. The deepest insight here isn't just knowing what EC2 or Lambda is. It's understanding that every single architectural choice you make, using Spot, accepting a Lambda cold start, paying for a dedicated host, it's all fundamentally a trade-off between operational control on one side and cost optimization on the other.
So the question to leave you with is, which of those two sides, control or cost, matters most to you for your next project or your biggest bottleneck right now? Where are you willing specifically to maybe give up some fine-grained control to slash operational overhead and cost? And conversely, where is that absolute control, maybe over latency or specific hardware, so critical that it justifies the higher cost and management effort? We hope this dive has given you a clearer framework for making those crucial decisions.